Well, it's good to have you here. I wanted to talk to you for some time. I have a number of your books, and I was thinking that sometimes it's kind of hard for me to tell where Barry Hanna begins and Gordon Lish leaves off, or vice versa. I'm trying to figure out who influenced who, because you both have very, very similar techniques. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I don't I really don't know that question. Gordon was a dear friend and editor of mine at Esquire. Gordon always went for the economic, the more assaultive, the quicker stop. I'm sure he influenced me by his editing. He's big on the blue pencil and hates unnecessary rhetoric. So that I had Hemingway and then Gordon. If Gordon writes like I do, I don't know what he's learned from me. Although I know he loves my work, and but I don't know what to do with any major influence. Now that Gordon is not my editor, maybe I write a little bit longer without hearing the master in back of me saying, that's it, got to go. Mm-hmm. Gordon's very good to me, very generous man, and I'm delighted with any affiliation.
I know Gordon pretty well and admire him and admire his work. So I had some I had mixed feelings about this legal case in which he sued Harper's.
Yeah, I knew about that.
Yeah, he won, and the judge awarded him $2, which the judge later rescinded. So for both parties, it was kind of a victory. Harper's lost but didn't have to pay any damages because there really weren't any damages. I'm glad for Gordon's sake that he won it, but being a journalist and a big believer in the First Amendment, I sometimes also want to side on the magazine. But at any rate, it's over, but it still it caused so much stir. I mean, it was an incredible story that it even made the front pages of the New York Times.
Did it?
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is.
Well, we want to talk not about Gordon Lish, of course, but about you. And before we work up to Bats Out of Hell, I'd like to find out a little bit about you, because you're a Southerner. You were born in Mississippi.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about your background and the kind of family that you grew up with.
All right. I grew up in Pascagoula and Clinton, Mississippi, a little village near the state capital, Jackson. My folks, middle-class Protestants, heavy on the Baptist for my mother's part, and a rather blithe and liberated youth with no crime in the neighborhood. I wandered through nature and town, and it was really kind of little heaven. I appreciate it more now that I'm older, because we made our own fun more. We always imagined fun. We didn't. I'm not going to give you an acorns and hardtack story, but there was no Nintendo, and you had to make your own games. Part of it was telling stories, having puppet shows. Well, you didn't want to bore your friends with a bad puppet show, even if you had a little aesthetic criteria, even at age 9. And I didn't know about it, but that's what I love, to make up stories. Then I was...
Well, sure, would you describe your household as a literary household?
No, not especially. My dad was a huge reader. After he retired, he read a book a day, just about... Otherwise, it was the Bible and devotional literature from my dear mother, who's still alive. I think a high school teacher brought poetry, made it real and good, Mrs. Blackwell. And in the third grade, a Harvard-trained lady in psychiatry taught. I don't know why we got her, but she loved the imagination, and she gave me credit for doing stories, and the others were doing kind of straight work. She was, you know, that was radical for Mississippi in the 50s. Yeah. So maybe I had some advantages just lucky, a couple of good props in college. You don't need but two or three in your college.
Did you go to Ole Miss?
No, I went to Mississippi College, and then up to really what became a committed writer at Arkansas, University of Arkansas, Fayetteville.
There, did you study, that's where you taught, or did you study at...
No, I got my degree, graduate degrees there.
At Fayetteville?
Yeah, no. Fayetteville, yeah. Now,
did you study creative writing, English?
Yeah, I got a master's in English and a thesis on Blake, and then a master in fine arts and writing. And for me, it was very good. I don't know if the workshop's good for everybody, but I needed the discipline. And got me an agent and sent me out into the world with a teaching job. I've always had to teach to support myself, except for about 2 years in Hollywood. I wrote scripts. Worked a little with Robert Altman. And otherwise, I taught on and on. And I teach now at Ole Miss and love it. I love it much more than I did when I was younger. I believe in it more.
Tell me about your work with Robert Altman.
Well, it was really out of the good graces. He paid me out of his pocket, maybe the rent, while I was scratching away at a script and was never produced. What's a man? This is a lovely, brilliant, literary genius. I think there's no doubt about it. I mean, it's wonderful to see him come back with this new movie, The Player. And he likes writers. He's one of the few that actually likes literature in Hollywood. And liked having me around. He liked talking ideas. I'll always be very thankful for him for pulling me through some kind of dire months. I had no other work at the time.
Tell me about your first literary work. I believe your first book was Airships.
It was Geronimo Rex. It's 20 years ago. It was greeted, hailed around. It was nominated for the National Book Award. It's about growing up in the South during the Civil Rights era and Elvis and the adventures of a trumpet man who fails and finds himself in trouble with some right-wing folks about towns, right-wing racist. But it's really just a kind of like a lot of first novel, just kind of a big howl. Here I am. This is the way it went. And I'm glad it was liked so much. Airships was 78. I had met the great master Gordon Lish by then. He loved my stories at Esquire, and I published a great deal there. That book came out. We won the Esquire Short Fiction Award, and I was just delirious because I've been reading Esquire for years. I had pictures of bohemian women from Esquire on my walls. I mean, this is like shooting for something and making the team. So it was a lot for a small town boy. I mean, love the writing because of the beautiful people you meet primarily, and it's one of the biggest, best things I know about it.
When you say because of the beautiful people you meet, are you talking about going to writers' conferences and meeting people there, or what?
Not only there, but I find fiction writers rather decent, straight-ahead, honest people. I don't find them inflated, greedy egos. I know there are a few of them like that, but most of them are right on the ground. I mean, they know what's possible, and they keep failing per day. If you keep failing per day, just shooting at it, you get a little humility. And we're all, trying to tear up the page, tear a new window, like Faulkner and Joyce.
I was going to say there must be a high degree of insecurity among the fiction writers.
Yeah, because it's not a highly regarded art. It is getting damn near china painting, because literary art is fascinating a lot of people. Some people say, the novel is dead. Even I am finding the novel so conforming, demanding of such a conservative form. I love the stories much better. I feel much more liberated, where I can actually ignore form or break out into more edges than a novel.
But many of the stories in Bats Out of Hell are almost novel length. Some of them are
right.
as long as some of the Ray, for example, is probably shorter than some of the novellas you have in the book.
Maybe. I don't know. I haven't looked at the length. I like the short novel. I find almost every novel overwritten and padded. I mean, every novel over 300 pages, I find I would have edited a little bit. I don't like artificial devices pulling you through like a dead body on the first page, and it hadn't changed from the 19th century. You just about have something like a dead body on the first page in every bestseller you got, or a dead body with no face, or none. So I get tired of what sells that way. I'm not interested in that. I think that novel literature should keep you turning the page because it is just giving you more available reality and the best that you can imagine.
Isn't that a strategy on the part of the publishing houses? I have a few thousand books at home.
Yeah.
And I notice that the older books are smaller books, not necessarily in total length, but the books physically are smaller, and books seem to be made bigger. It seems that the publishers want books to look bigger.
So right.
Perhaps they feel that the reader gets his money out of the book.
That's right. It's almost like having 100 yards of football field every time. I mean, they weigh about the same. They look about the same. And the idea is that you will be enveloped by a cumulative action. And it's beautiful if you are. I agree. If it keeps you riveted to your seat. But I don't know, stop and start a novel 12, 13 times. Everybody does now. And I kind of go back to Poe. I like something that will just really knock you on the head sitting in one sitting. I think it's the best art experience available.
You know, I had to fly down to Houston, Texas about 3 weeks ago, and I decided I would take a couple of paperbacks with me. So I went to the newsstand and began looking for a book to take with me. I couldn't find any books. I mean, there were some Stephen Kings and some Dean Koontz and some Janet Daly and Judith Krantz, and I just didn't feel like reading any of those books. But way at the end, there was a very slim section called Classics, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and I spotted a book that I had never read, always should have read, and always wanted to read, but somehow never got around to. It was Flaubert's Madame Bovary.
Right.
So, and I bought it. It was even cheaper than the latest Stephen King, and I bought it. I could also, and I read it on the airplane, and it's not that thick a novel.
No, it's 300 pages or something, isn't it? Yeah.
But I could see in that novel how almost every other novel since that time has been shaped.
Well, the Russians wrote big honky books. I mean, you know, the students really complain. But we'll talk about A Room Emptier, Hossein, Brothers Karamazov. I teach that every now and then. Modern European novel that I don't miss. But the ideal, you read the novel that was the ideal when I was in writing school, Flaubert, Madame Bovary, the Le Mot Juste. I mean, every word in order, everything perfect. A book that took 7 years. I don't believe in that anymore. I don't believe in giving up 7 years of your life for much at all. Certainly Madame Bovary was worth it, but a lot of wonderful books are written in 6-10 weeks, you know, and Stephen Crane did Red Badge of Courage in 10 days. I kind of like to get in fast. It's a personal thing with me. I think almost everything's overwritten. With CNN around, everybody knows exactly the same thing. There's so much you don't have to write now. I think that the writer, it's up to the writer to get to things that cannot be duplicated anywhere. TV, painting, music, television.
Yeah. Well, nobody's going to ever accuse you of overwriting, that's for sure. But You have such a wide range, and going through the stories in your collection, Bats Out of Hell, by the way, which it's a very difficult thing to sit in just a couple of sittings and read these stories.
Well, there's too many of them.
Yeah, it's just too many. After a while, things begin to jumble up, and I begin to get confused. Some of these stories are very, very accessible, and some you really have to work at. Some I didn't...
Oh, really? Okay. This is what my wife says. I mean, this is always baffles me that my work should ever have been considered difficult, but I understand it is, and inaccessible to some people who are bright. I didn't ever mean to be inaccessible. I was never going for deliberate Faulknerian, or certainly not obscurity, which I think is a great crime. So I'm surprised always when somebody says, I just couldn't quite get into it, you know, for good reasons, I guess.
Well, that's sometimes you have to get on the author's wavelength, and then everything becomes clear, and sometimes you just don't. It's like poetry can be difficult, too. In fact, a lot of you do have a poet's gift for writing, obviously, even though you focus in prose, but a lot of it reads like poetry. And poetry is not always accessible. Sometimes that's why they have courses in it, to explain it. And then all of a sudden there's a revelation, and it becomes clear. But there are no prose guides for your work. But most of it is perfectly accessible. Rat-faced Annie. I don't have my glasses. I wish there was one word that stuck out. I meant to check it in the... I'm not going to have to look for it.
There's right.
One word that kept popping up, and you probably know what it is and what I'm talking about, and I didn't...
Well, I don't know. What story?
I remember the story.
I may have forgotten the word. Every now and then I just get a word I adore and throw it in there, but... It's I love the music of the language. I think English is quite glorious. I'm flattered, complimented that you say it. Some of it is like poetry. But, you know, poetry, you do have courses in poetry, and yet it should be the language of utmost clarity, clearer than anything, even this news report, this chat I'm reading in the big caps from your machine on the table here. I'm for utmost clarity, and I don't want to ever be confusing. And I really have no patience for writers who are deliberately inaccessible. I think that probably turns away a lot of people. They say, oh no, that's literature. I'm going to get me a Stephen King. You know, there's a bit too much arrogance connected with obscurity in the academic world, I know.
The Southern writing tradition, that has something to do with language, doesn't it? That it seems to me that the Southern writers just stand out in terms of their language in the way that Midwesterners, such as myself, don't. Hemingway aside, Fitzgerald aside, but
Sherwood Anderson. I mean, the Midwest. They say that the South and the East are New England are the only two cultures, and that everything else is a mix. But those writers you mentioned, Fitzgerald, Hemingway, and Anderson, have a very fine pitch. They have music. The Southerner is probably influenced by the King James Version still, even in 1992, and by music very much. I mean, there's nothing out there in many of those little towns but music. You just don't connect anywhere except on the radio. The voice is terribly important, especially to poor people. The blues of the Delta, all you got is a voice and a bad guitar, and you got to make something from almost nothing.
Well, certain music plays a role in almost every story.
Right,
literally, characters play instruments, trumpets, trombones, guitars.
Some of them do, yeah. I tried it as a trumpet man. I didn't have the dedication, and I wanted to be Miles Davis and nothing, so yeah, I quit early. And I'm glad to see my son on guitar is a much better, more devoted musician than I am, so that's one thing good about having children. They can do some of your dreams, even when you don't.
It's a very difficult thing to try to categorize writers, but I try to do it mentally anyway. So I'm trying to see if I could group you with Southern writers such as Reynolds Price and people like that, or the postmodernists, which you almost could fit in with. These are people like William Gass and Robert Coover and John Barth.
I don't think so. I've been called postmodernist because I take a lot of freedom with form. But a postmodernist is generally provoking the audience into laughing at the whole idea of narrative and satirizing in almost every sentence. I don't like that. I like to believe a story. I don't like to hear a coy writer behind it manipulating things at all. So I'm very against the notion of hyperfiction or that. I'm fairly traditional. I like the old-fashioned tale. I just like it told with a certain sensibility that may employ words you don't just hear on the street, you know, when somebody selling papers.
Well, William Gass was sitting where you're sitting a couple of years ago, and he said his goal is to play games with the language, mm-hmm. and the story was not particularly important. And in fact, right. Gordon Lish said the same thing. He said, "I don't really care what you say, I just care how you say it."
Right. That goes so far, but I do think subject matter is crucial. I think you can feel that language is leaving and becoming its own gas, and it may be intellectually interesting, but doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the body. I like the visceral and the heart, too. So there's so much pure head work in postmodernism. It reminds me of jaded graduate teachers. I mean, it's donnish, and it's coy, and I just can't bear that attitude.
I guess you're in the South to stay, huh?
It seems that way. I didn't think I'd go back to Mississippi. I was out of the state for about 15 years, but I was captured by Oxford and a new marriage to Susan, my wife, and it's a lovely little town of 10,000. I think I'm a small town person, and I like music. They have good music and marvelous, bright friends and sport and nature, and that's about it. And I also feel like I'm doing good, not as a missionary, but I think my state needs me, and I want to be there for its literature. Plus, it's one of its strong suits, one of its own really wonderful natural resources, is writers, musicians.
Having grown up in the South, I guess you've seen a lot of changes in terms of race relations.
Yeah. Yeah, I have. Mississippi is the most integrated state in the Union in many ways.
Because Ole Miss, there was a lot of violence.
Oh, yes. In 62, it's 30 years ago, they were fighting it out against the FBI. The students were throwing bricks and Ole Miss has tried to shake that image for a long time with a lot of encouraging affirmative action programs. And I like to think that race relations are better, but I'm a realist, and it is still a long, long road. And I admire the blacks still who come to Ole Miss, which is, there are only 7% of them, and it's still a brave act, but a good education, as good as the state affords. So I'm cheering for everybody, and I want to get along, and because the white people don't realize it. they've been talking black for a long time. They are black people in the South. I mean, we're black. White people are black. Black people are white, and we're Jewish. You know, the Church, the Judeo-Christian. We're three races down there, and if you just get honest, there's some Yankees come down, can't tell the difference between the black speech and white speech. I mean, who taught who, you know? So I try to remind people that you're using a bunch of voices, different voices, even if you're Scots-Irish, you're black, white, Jewish, and you bring a lot. You're a lot more than you think you are, and you better get honest about it.
You had mentioned that there's a storytelling tradition that probably is influenced by the King James Version of the Bible in the South. But what religious influences, if any, have permeated your work?
The Protestant wing of faith with, I remember the 50s preachers were much heavier advocates of fire and brimstone because of the H-bomb, the A-bomb hovering over everything, and they are now, so it was more humanistic ministering now. But they would scare the hell out of you in the 50s. And so there's fear. Also, a kind of wicked regard for the Catholics around you who were aliens and, you know, popish. They were very strange people. I don't think I knew anybody Jewish until I was in college.
There are no religious strains running through your work. I haven't defined any.
Yeah, there are. There are. It's not announced, but I think there's a certainty that there's judgment, that the chicken comes home to roost, and that people are concerned certainly with guilt and atonement. And lately in this book, I noticed that people are looking for missions. They're getting middle-aged, and they're worried that they don't make any sense, and that their lives have not been significant, and they want mission. They want purpose. It brings them into a commitment that could be foolish or desperate and high drama, but that also was instilled early in all our church camps, that you were born for a purpose, young man, and you do your purpose. And
now you're teaching creative writing at University of Mississippi,
right?
Obviously, the whole structure of writing and publishing has changed over the years. Where does a young writer today place his work?
He will usually start with the little magazines, the quarterlies, unless he's awfully good and somewhat lucky. Like the Carolina Quarterly was my first publication. It's the same now. They still read unsolicited work. The big slick magazines that published fiction are not many. I don't know anybody who makes a living writing short stories for magazines. Not one. He may pay a little alimony or something. John Updike, I think he said, paid alimony with his reviews. But it will be, there are a lot of wonderful small magazines. America is still very vigorous in small productions. The small productions are better than they were when I was a student and a young writer. And This is the only place where you can just stamp something and send it off. I don't think much has changed, except it's just a lot less honor given literature today than it used to. It's everybody wants to be an anchor person like you or a talk show. I mean, you are the god of most of my students. If they had your job,
not me.
If they had your job, they would have realized a great many dreams. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that it's a visible age. It's a tyranny of the visual also. TV, and people don't trust the page or impatient with the page.
Isn't it interesting, as I remarked to you a moment ago, that there was so much commercial fiction that I saw on the newsstand and looking for a paperback book. And there seems to be a resistance to a degree toward reading literary fiction, and yet, when you go to a motion picture or turn on television, what do you see? Fiction.
Absolutely. Isn't that
sure?
Right, it's theater. And usually bad, but it's theater. And they say, you know, had Shakespeare been allowed, he'd be writing for TV. Well, I hope. Where is he? I'd love to have him around on the TV. But You're right. You don't want to get too nostalgic and weepy and become one of these fine artists, you know, about the passing of honored skills. Art goes on, and I like to be in the fight. I'm glad I made the team. I just love to read, and there's still a few million in the country who do. I wouldn't have had that big crisis you do about picking out commercial literature. I don't mind a good commercial book. My friend John Grisham has done beautifully with the firm, and he's from Oxford also, where I live. And he's the best-selling writer, I guess, in America outside Stephen King right now. Now, if you want to take a good commercial idea and do it well, that's a fine thing.
Oh, I don't disagree with you. And in fact, I think that Stephen King can be a much better writer than he has.
But well, I think Stephen King is an immensely talented man.
He's a genius.
He can tell a beautiful story, especially about teenagers. He's probably the best writer about the teenage mind we've got. And they say Americans never get really past teenage, so he's got a hell of a lot of people listening. So these are not untalented people, although you mentioned some people that are graceless on they don't have the ear. I can't read something that just bangs on the ear and that's dumb. I think, but the bestseller that just tells you what you really already knew, like The Rich Are Filthy and Have Trouble, which is what most people want to hear. I resent that, but. Mario Puzo's The Godfather is a good book, and you know I love these successes. I cheer for these people. There is good commercial fiction also.
Well, your students at Ole Miss, when they come in to class for the first day, what sort of drill do you give them? Because obviously you want to give them reasonable expectations about their potential work.
Right. Well, the reasonable expectation is that one out of 100 students that I see will have the goods to publish distinctive fiction. I don't ever say that, but I think that you know, it's always along. There's no factory for writers ever. I mean, there may have been some people together at one time in that workshop 47 in Harvard or something back in the 30s. And there are a bunch of writers, say, in Oxford now. It's almost a coincidence, though. There's no factory. You don't ever see a school, Iowa, Stanford, Arkansas, just firing them out like dice. It takes more endurance than students suspect. It takes patience. And I just have them write 4 stories, and I give standard A, B, C, D grades. I like that. That's the system I like. It tells you about where you are. They know I'm a professional writer, and I give them exactly what an editor would write, just like a professional editor. And they get better. And, 19 to 20 students I've had over 20-something years teaching or writing novels, so a couple of them supporting themselves. I'm kind of proud of that, but it doesn't sound like much, does it?
Well, when you think of the number of people who say they want to be writers and those who actually succeed, it's probably a proper percentage.
Yeah, it is. Well, everybody feels he can write because he's been using the language in some way. It's not exactly the piano. I mean, ever since you said mama, you'd have been doing something to it. But
a piano, whether you play it well or not, there's a mathematical structure to play
right.
A piano with writing. Right. That has to go by the wayside. It's something completely different.
Right.
And it's not like writing a business letter either.
There's a dearth of originality on campuses now. I think people are worried too much about money. There are fewer individuals, fewer of the freaks with missions like I went to school with, fewer wild men and women. Things are fairly frightened and conformist. All the rebellion is done through beer and imitating Budweiser ads. I don't see enough courageous individualism around. I'd like this administration to make a climate for that. I hope it will.
Well, Barry Hannon, I'd like to see you and Harry Cruz get together at the bar one of these days, but you gave up drinking.
I think Harry did, too, last time I saw him in Memphis. Some of us don't get the magic we did. We get only the black drug. And I don't advocate anything to the young writer except the loneliness with a pencil and a white sheet of paper, which you really get to adore. You really get to adore that loneliness and making something out of nothing, just like you did when you were nine.
Well, I get panicky when I see a pencil and a white sheet of paper now that we're in the age of computers. Do you still use a white sheet of paper and a pencil?
Absolutely. Well, a pen, yeah. Yeah, I don't even have a machine, but I like the physical part. I like the sounds the typewriter makes. I don't like the silence of computers. But it's my addiction. It's just a part of the actual physical stuff that I love. Shelby Foote is the most antiquarian of us. In his study once, he uses quills with nibs and dipped ink. He wrote those wonderful Civil War histories. It's idealized language such as would come from the best letters from soldiers during the war. If you read those, the letters were so beautifully literate from Yankees and Confederate soldiers writing their mamas. And that's another beauty about Shelby's work. He got right into that exquisite rhetoric in his Civil War pieces.
I had James Dickey up here a couple of times, and I had been trying to encourage him to switch to a word processor. He collects typewriters. He has a typewriter in every room. And he said, no, I have to look at each draft. I'd like to put a poem on a piece of paper, and then I might have several drafts, and I can line them up. I said, well, you can do that on a computer. He said, but then I'd have to learn how to use a computer.
Right, he could fly airplanes. But there's something difficult about that computer that it was just like algebra to me. I knew more algebra than I wanted to. It was just I didn't want to get in that world, and so I just took my C and was happy. there's some things that I just don't covet. A certain world I don't covet. I like what I'm doing in a simple process, that physical stuff of writing.
Well, yeah. Like writing, but it is a way of life with you. It has been. I don't think that's going to go away, is it?
No, it's not going to. It's all I've got. I can play the trumpet a little, you know, tennis decently, but writing is the beauty. And especially straight. I just adore the days. I buy a notebook. There's a kind of a minor euphoria, joy about working that nothing else has given me.
Yeah. Well, you're unique, Barry Hanna, and Bats Out of Hell, your new collection of stories. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me.